Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We have a lot of ground to cover in this hour. It all begins with a question.
When you graduated, what did you do next?
I joined the Peace Corps.
Tara Lloyd of Mount Sterling, among the more than 100 Kentuckians interviewed by John Wilson for the new book from University Press of Kentucky, Voices from the Peace Corps, 50 Years of Kentucky Volunteers, co-authored with his wife, Ann Jean Wilson. Jack Wilson, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And chapter one of your book, Voices from the Peace Corps, raises a question that seems a good place to begin this conversation. Why we went? Tell us briefly about your own Peace Corps experience.
Well, people join the Peace Corps for a variety of reasons. Some of them have changed over the last 60 years. Some of them have not. They've just had them added. I think in my case, in Ann Jean's, we were college seniors. We were trying to figure out what we were going to do with the rest of our lives. We were planning on getting married. We wanted to be useful to other people, but we also had an idea of travel and maybe a little bit of adventure. And we'd heard Kennedy's inaugural, where he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And joining the Peace Corps appeared to be a thing you could do. He started that in 61, and that's when we decided to join.
Not like running off to the Foreign Legion. It was more about getting out there and helping the world, right?
Yes. And you weren't quite sure what you could do, but you had enough self-confidence based on a college education in the U.S. that there were some skills you had. In our case, we went as teachers.
And where'd you go?
We went to Liberia. And of course, ironically, Liberia has a good connection to Kentucky. Henry Clay, of course, was for a long time head of the American Colonization Society, which resettled American slaves on the west coast of Africa, which was Liberia. And in fact, not 10 miles from the school where we taught was a community called Clay Ashland.
How about that? You all went as teachers. More generally, what do Peace Corps workers do?
A whole variety of things. They may be in environmental issues, or they may be in small business. You may also know that I spent a couple of years, more than that, 5 years, as a Peace Corps staff person. And the programs that we had in Sierra Leone, some of them were agriculture-based, and some had public health components to them. In Fiji, where I directed the Peace Corps program, we had a sizable co-op program helping local farmers organize cooperatives so that they might get a little better price for their products.
Having been through this experience, and I have to believe that this is true of so many Peace Corps workers, but it must really expand your worldview and your attitude toward life in general.
Oh, absolutely. You have no idea what you're getting yourself into. I think that's the first thing to say. And you find yourself immersed suddenly in a totally different culture. And you have to begin to sort out what's important and what isn't important in your life. And how is it these people live and carry on their lives? What's important to them? And should some of those things be important to me? The one thing I can say is almost without exception, Peace Corps volunteers will say,
It changed my life.
Wow. Well, in this book, you present oral history narratives of more than 100 Kentuckians who have served in the Peace Corps. Could you think of an example or a couple of examples that stand out in your mind?
Several, I guess. One, I would say, might be Kay Roberts, who worked in Ecuador as a Peace Corps volunteer, then came home to Kentucky and for many years headed up the Kentucky-Ecuador Partners Program and worked in the Office of Other Affairs here at UK. And a man from Eastern Kentucky who went to Guinea and as a chemist got interested further in some research work, came back, went to medical school, and opened a clinic in McKee in Jackson County. A wide variety of people.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, the Peace Corps was created by President Kennedy in 1961. And with the creation of this organization came a message to the world that we wanted to convey by its existence and its mission. What would you say that that is?
Well, that Americans are willing and able to be of assistance to other people, but they're also willing to learn about the rest of the world. That's part of the goals of the Peace Corps. The three goals were to go and be of assistance where you could in another country. The second was to allow people in that country to learn something about Americans and what we did and how we lived and governed and so forth. And then thirdly, to come back home and help educate our friends and relatives and others about the rest of the world.
Well, without getting too political here, but would you say we could use some more of that today?
I certainly think so, yes.
Are there guidelines for determining whether or not you are right for this work? Is there something you can look at and say, yep, that's me, or maybe I better not do this?
Well, I mean, there's some basic requirements that Peace Corps itself has, and those are generally, and they've changed a little bit over the years, but they're looking primarily for somebody with a demonstrated skill or a college education.
What would you say are some reasons not to join the Peace Corps, such as only because you want to find yourself?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say nobody has ever done it for that reason, and indeed found themselves in a place they didn't expect. I don't think people should join the Peace Corps if their primary motive is to get a good job. It's not a high-paying job. It's 2 years of, in some cases, pretty tough living and cultural challenge and patience, but ultimately, I would say personal growth.
I would say those are pretty enriching things that you can't take to the bank, maybe, but you could take through your life.
Exactly.
Voices from the Peace Corps, 50 Years of Kentucky Volunteers, is the ninth volume in Kentucky Remembered, an oral history series. Why is it important to collect these and present these oral histories?
Well, because it's a piece of Kentucky just like it is a piece of the United States. And Kentuckians joined the Peace Corps. Their stories, I believe, should be heard and seen, and their experiences shared. And their experiences vary greatly. You know, in the early days of Peace Corps, there was a lot of concern about whether Americans were tough enough to live in some parts of the world. One thing we found out is, yeah, there are some things that are uncomfortable, maybe to get up in the middle of the night and have to walk through the dark to get to an outdoor latrine or have no running water or electricity are inconvenient, but you really can't live without those things if you need to, and not all Peace Corps volunteers do. Hmm. I've known volunteers who've lived in apartments in a large city, not unsimilar to what you might hear in the States in some places, but their jobs were different.
Mm-hmm. The Return Peace Corps Volunteer Oral History Project is archived at the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History in the University of Kentucky Libraries. Recordings of these interviews are available online at Kentucky Oral History. That's one word, KentuckyOralHistory.org. And you'll find that link along with our conversation with Jack Wilson on our site at eswek.org. Jack Wilson, thank you so much for your service and for joining us here in the studio to talk about the experiences in this wonderful book.
Well, thank you for having me and for helping us encourage other people to both listen to those oral histories and to read the book.
Well, I hope they do both. Thank you very much.
Listen, baby.
Kentuckians have gone on to do great things out in the world. In this installment of our Kentucky History series, Stephanie Lang, editor of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, focuses on one of them.
Dr. Anthony Harkins is a professor of history at Western Kentucky University and a scholar of U.S. popular culture history, particularly representations of Appalachia and rural America. He is the author of Hillbilly, A Cultural History of an American Icon, and co-editor with Meredith McCarroll of Appalachia Reckoning, A Region Response to Hillbilly Elegy. More recently, I had the opportunity to work with Dr. Harkins on an article for the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society on a lesser-known figure in Kentucky history. Kentucky certainly has a really rich history regarding broadcasting and broadcasters, including folks like Steve Inskeep and Diane Sawyer. But a lesser-known figure that you explore in your research is Julian Goodman. And he's a former NBC News executive and Kentucky native. So to get us started, who was Julian Goodman? And how did you learn about his story? And how did his Kentucky roots influence his career?
Well, thanks, Stephanie. It's great to talk to you. Julian Goodman was, as I learned, a real force in the history of television. He was the president of NBC from 1966 to 74, CEO. And before that, he was with NBC News. He did all manner of firsts for television, which we can talk about. He was born in Glasgow. He went to Western Kentucky University, or Kentucky State Teachers College at that point. And he maintained tight roots with this region, coming back regularly. And so has lots of family here. His cousin was the president of Western, Dero Downing. His other cousin was Joe Downing, the artist. And so he had a lot of connections to this area. I came into it knowing about him because I saw a story come across that his papers were at Vanderbilt University Archives. And they were online, or, you know, scheduled listing for them was online, and it was just fascinating to see what there was, and it was close by. And so, given my work on questions of rural and urban and flyover country, it fit in really nicely. And it was a great experience to go through his papers and just to see all these windows into Kentucky history, television history, and really American history.
And you mentioned some of the firsts that he, you know, he had pioneering roles in a series of firsts, including the great debates between Kennedy and Nixon, which is, you know, very fascinating. What is the significance of this, and how did this impact future political elections and how we consume news today?
Yeah. Well, I think he was really quite central in making television central to American politics. He came in kind of at the right at the beginning in the World War II years and worked his way up sort of by accident, but also by sketch, by a plan. He was involved not just in the Nixon-Kennedy debates, but involved in first getting live recordings of Congress on radio and then later television, including from the very beginning of the Truman Doctrine, and then the very first recordings from the Rose Garden of a presidential event with President Eisenhower. And then with President, or then with Kennedy, he was instrumental in the president, the second of the three presidential debates, showing how utterly essential television was going to be to sort of selling a candidate and letting people see the political leaders. And then he was also central to the coverage of the Kennedy assassination at NBC News, where they ran, I think it was 43 hours in a row without breaking to cover that event. And he was just he was always a figure who was very focused on the importance of media coverage of politics and making it as public as possible. He eventually even pushed for and was a leading figure in getting C-SPAN coverage of congressional, the floor of the Congress as well.
One of the hallmarks of your research and that came through very much in the article was you talk about Goodman's view of network television as an essential public good, and this was certainly influenced by his Kentucky background. How does this impact his outspoken support for First Amendment rights for a free press? And thinking particularly about today, and, you know, current political coverage, what kind of similarities do you see today on this particular topic?
Yeah, doing this part of the research was just fascinating, and there was just constant overlap because he was very much involved in trying to cover, you know, his years of leadership, late 60s, early 70s, were certainly dramatic ones. And he was part of all of that television coverage of the 1968 political convention, Democratic convention in Chicago, which you know, had massive protests and police actions, through the early years of the Nixon administration and the Watergate times as well. And it was fascinating how much opposition there was to, particularly among conservatives and the Republican Party, to the mass media and television in particular as kind of having too much power and too much influence and too much ability to shape public attitudes towards politicians. And he pushed back against the idea that this was too much power for television and always framed it as it was the public's right to know, not the broadcaster's right to broadcast, and that restricting media, be it television or radio or press, was restricting a fundamentally important thing, which was that the public needed to be able to hold accountable politicians and know what was going on. And this led him to become a real focus of the Nixon administration, Vice President Agnew, and in fact, he was the only television executive to make it onto Nixon's famous enemies list, which he did not appreciate being on there. But I think it showed what an impact he had had and what an absolute heroic defender of First Amendment rights and free speech and the importance of media coverage was. You know, he very much stood up for that, and I can only imagine what he would have thought of the last few years that we've gone through.
So shifting gears just a little bit to kind of wrap us up. Goodman's, you know, how he really shaped how we consume political media. He also, and this is something that I thought was fascinating from your research, he had an impact on cultural programming. And several of these projects had a huge impact on popular culture and continue to have a massive following today. What are two examples listeners would be surprised to learn about?
Now, I was surprised to learn about it, too. You know, he came up through news, and that was always his first love. But he was very much involved, of course, as president of NBC on all aspects of television. And two things. One was history of the NFL, and the other was the history of Star Trek. So the NFL, you know, when he was there, was still divided between two leagues, the NFL and the AFL. And the AFL was very much the poor cousin, as it were. And he came up with a strategy to basically overpay the AFL for coverage of their games so that they could then pay their players more money, particularly superstars like Joe Namath. That they could then reach parity with the NFL, and then, you know, NBC would be able to cover both leagues in a sense. And this is indeed what happened. You know, the amount of money that they got through these television contracts let the AFL rise, eventually be able to be competitive with the NFL, and of course, eventually win the Super Bowl. And then they merged into one league and, of course, became the entertainment behemoth that the NFL is. So I think in many ways that was, in part, his doing. Star Trek was another interesting example. It was a show, you know, given its enormous influence on the culture, we sometimes forget that it was not a terribly popular show when it first came on. It was just too far out there for a lot of people. But it had an intense audience of particularly high-educated and higher-income people, and he recognized the value of that audience, even though the overall ratings weren't that good, and kept it on the air despite efforts to get it off, and also in the face of an enormous fan campaign to keep it on the air. Kept it on just long enough that it would reached a point where it could be syndicated, and then through its syndication over the years, it developed a much, much broader following and, of course, became, you know, the cultural touchstone that it is now.
So from political debates to the NFL and Star Trek, he definitely had a very interesting career. Thank you so much, Dr. Harkins, for sharing Julian Goodman's story with us, and I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So nice to talk to you.
Goodman, name ring a bell?
I'm one of the Goodmans from Glasgow, Barron County, who is a cousin of Julian Goodman's.
That's Bill Goodman, the longtime KET journalist and now head of Kentucky Humanities.
If you know anything about Glasgow, you know there are a lot of Goodmans that were there, not as many as before. And this was a gentleman that was a great influence on all of us as family members. But when Julian Goodman came to the Goodman family reunion in Fountain Run, people set up and took notice. And I thought maybe I would use my relationship with him and what I knew about him when I was at Western Kentucky University studying broadcasting myself, and got the idea that all I would need to do is to go to New York and meet with Julian, and he would give me a job at NBC, at the network. He was president of the entire NBC network. So I did that. I drove partway, parked my car, got on a Greyhound bus, and took the bus into New York City, got a room at the 42nd Street Y, and had an appointment with Julian at 30 Rockefeller Center the next morning. Went up so many stories, I've never been that high in my life, no pun intended. And Julian and I had a great conversation about family, about the reunion, and about my work in broadcasting at Western Kentucky University. And when I said, Julian, I would think that maybe I could take a job as a page for The Tonight Show. And he said, well, that might work out at some time, but you haven't finished your degree at Western, have you? And I said, no, sir, I haven't. He said, well, let me give you the best advice I can. You need to get back on that bus and back in your car and drive down to Bowling Green and finish up your degree. Work as hard as you can, get you a local job in news, and then we'll see about you moving up to the network. Well, that was the best advice that anyone ever gave me. I gave up my dream and hope of becoming a page at NBC. I got back to Western. I had a radio job there. I went on and worked in several places in television. Never did make it to the network, but I always remembered and thanked Julian at one of our Goodman reunions that he attended, and to thank him for the advice that he had given me.
You can hear Bill Goodman host Think History daily here on WEKU. Coming up after the break, Kentucky's not just horse and cattle country.
There are about 7,000 sheep and goat farmers in Kentucky.
And singer-songwriter Joe Pug is Duane Lundy's guest on the latest in our series, Depth of Field. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council, asking you to save the dates, September 11th and 12th, for the Kentucky Crafted Outdoor Market at Waveland. The Kentucky Arts Council is partnering with Lexington's Waveland State Historic Site to present this outdoor celebration of the best in Kentucky-made art and craft. See and purchase artwork from Kentucky Crafted artists, hear great tunes from some of the state's best musical acts, enjoy Kentucky-made food and beverages, and much, much more. Tickets are $5 for adults and can be purchased online or at the event. Visit artscouncil.ky.gov for more information and to purchase your tickets. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In late April, I talked with Patrick Angel about his concept for the development of a sheep and goat industry on reclaimed mine sites in eastern Kentucky. And at the time, I said that we would follow up with a look into what sort of investment and skills in both animal husbandry and business it takes to make a living in this. So to learn more about small ruminant farming, we turn to Kelly Yates, Executive Director of the Kentucky Sheep and Goat Development Office, and she joins us from Winchester. Hi, Kelly.
Hello, how are you?
Doing real good. And first, let me just ask you, what does your office do?
Our office is an umbrella organization for the Kentucky Goat Producers and the Kentucky Sheep and Wool Producers Association. So we help them conduct education and promotion and marketing activities for sheep and goats across the state.
And do you actually raise these animals yourself?
I have a couple of goats. But my family has been in the sheep business for 32 years. We have had meat sheep on our farm ever since I was old enough to have a 4-H project.
And so I take it there are successful sheep and goat enterprises around Kentucky?
Absolutely. There are about 7,000 sheep and goat farmers in Kentucky.
Wow. So we're interested in potential businesses that could make a successful go of it in a diversified eastern Kentucky economy, raising sheep and goats on reclaimed coal mine sites, for example. Is there a particular reason why these sites and small ruminants work well together?
I think there's several reasons why they would work well together. Getting into the sheep and goat business is one of the more easy things to do as far as getting into agriculture because the overhead cost of getting started is not as much as, let's say, getting into the cattle business. Or if you wanted to get into large-scale vegetable production, you have to buy a lot of big equipment for that, and you have to have a lot of labor. So sheep and goats, you don't really have to have lots of equipment. You don't have to have super fancy facilities, and you don't have to have a huge number of them either to do certain projects. So when we talk about strip mines, it would be nice to have lots of sheep and goats on those because those strip mines are really large. But an individual can get into the business with very low overhead, thus making their return on investment more quickly than some other agricultural ventures.
What about what is now growing on many of those reclaimed sites? What about the forages found on these sites?
Sure. We've looked at a variety of different sites, and of course, the forages can range just like they would anywhere. But sheep and goats tend to eat plants in fields that, let's say, cows or horses would not eat. So putting them on a reclaimed strip mine would be a good way to manage the forage that's on those sites. It would actually even help take out what some of us would call weeds. and allow more of the grasses to grow, because they will eat the weeds first and then they'll go for the grasses after that. So you can use sheep and goats as a forage management tool to help you reach whatever the goal is in that forage operation that you have.
What are some key things, even curveballs, that a person considering going into this business really needs to know?
Sure. So smaller production is, I say it's easy, but it's not always easy. So because of our amount of rainfall and our weather conditions here with it being hot, the two biggest problems that most people have in their small ruminant operations are going to be parasite management and foot problems. So parasites might be like single-celled organisms, but I swear they can really get the best of us. Sometimes they know better than we do. So there's a variety of different tools and methods that people can utilize to manage those. You'll never get rid of them. They will always be there. They're just in the environment. You just have to learn the ways that work best for you in managing those. And then foot problems, you can eliminate foot problems over time. Again, it just comes down to the management that you use on those animals. But we're wet here and we're humid here, so we do have those foot problems with animals.
What about technology? We hear about agri-tech in some other areas of agriculture, cattle farming, for example. What about technology in this industry?
Sure. Actually, technology in sheep and goats can look very similar to what we have in cattle. So a lot of people are using the RFID tags, which, you know, can connect to your computer programs and can keep track of all of your record keeping, which is really a fabulous thing to do, especially if you're looking at having large numbers in a large space, let's say on a strip mine type situation. If you had the RFID tags, you could set up, you know, a portable working system, and you can have those animals come through a couple times of the year, and you just wave your wand, and that tells you exactly which animal it is and, you know, how many offspring they had, and if there was any kind of issues with them at some point, you know, you can keep those kind of notes in there. I think record keeping is really the key in order to help people realize if they're being profitable in a small ruminant operation, because you can cull easier based on those records. You can keep your parasite records, for example. You can tell which animals have to be treated more than others, and you can cull based on that, and cull based on the amount of production that an animal makes too.
Kelly, are sheep and goats compatible with agroforestry, raising them on abandoned surface mine sites that have been reforested?
I think there's definitely the opportunity for that. The one thing you have to keep in mind is that goats are considered more of browsers, so they kind of eat from top down, and sheep are more grazers, so they kind of eat with their heads down instead of up.
Hmm.
So you can utilize both of them, because, you know, if you're going to do a forage or, you know, an agri-silvopopulation population, you know, like project like that, you can utilize both of those animals for the advantages that they offer. The one thing that you're going to want to think about is protecting the trees that you don't want goats to get to, because they will girdle trees. They will literally chew the bark off as high up as they can reach down to the ground, and that will kill a tree. So if you just want to use them to get rid of the invasive species in a particular project like that, so you just have to protect the things you don't want them to eat, and then just let them get at, you know, the stuff you want to get rid of, and they'll do that for you.
So what market should be targeted, and how does that determine which breed you raise?
We have a really good marketing system in Kentucky, and a lot of that is based on what we call graded sales. So the Kentucky Department of Agriculture has a grader, and he goes to these different graded sales, and he literally puts his hands on every animal that comes in through that sale. So he's trying to feel for finish and muscling, and he's going to group the animals based on what kind of type of finish that they have. And then the buyers come in and they buy those grades in bulk. Goats, for example, you have selection 1, 2, and 3. They'll put all the 1s together, all the 2s together, and all the 3s. And those buyers will buy them as a group. And when they do that, they will typically pay a few more cents per pound, because we're providing them a volume of animals. They don't have to sit through a sale and buy them each one by one. you know, in the head-to-head sales. Greatest sales work out really well because you don't have to find the buyers. You don't have to negotiate prices. You don't have to do any of that kind of work. You can raise the animals, which is what you love to do, and then let somebody else handle the marketing. So you take them to the greatest sales, and you drop them off. You can stay and watch them sell if you want to, and then you get a check. Super easy to do. The advantages that we have found in the graded market system, we've had it for, I'm going to say, 15 years, 15 to 20 years. And that market has created a marketing trend for our state. So we can typically tell you when the prices are going to be higher and when they're going to be lower for different weight ranges. So based on that marketing trend, and then based on when you want to have lambs or kids, whether you want to have them in the fall or the winter or in the spring, that's going to kind of determine when you should market those animals in order to hit that optimum marketing price. So, for example, if you land or kid in the fall, your goal is going to be to try to market those animals in like February or March. That's the time of the year when the prices are the highest. That's when a lot of the ethnic holidays are happening, and that's when Easter is happening. So the prices are generally through the roof in February, March, and April. If you're lambing in the winter, let's say like January, then you're going to try to hit a lighter weight animal in like March or April. So Katahdin, hair sheep, they're really good at making lightweight animals that are, they may not be completely finished, but they're at a good finish for that market at that particular time. If you lamb and kid in April, then you're probably going to want to hold those animals over through the summer and hit more of a heavier weight market in the fall, like around December or November, and sell more pounds than you are necessarily like you would in the spring where you're going to sell a lighter weight animal at a different price. So any of those three lambing and kidding periods are profitable. It just depends on what you want to do.
Do you see the small ruminant industry, sheep and goats, as a realistic economic option for Eastern Kentucky?
I think it's super realistic. If I think we're talking in Eastern Kentucky, you're probably talking smaller plots of ground than obviously we're talking in Western Kentucky. So again, being able to get into an ag industry where you don't have a whole lot of overhead on the get up, which is where your sheep and goats would come in, and you don't have to have a lot of fancy facilities, I feel like it's a very good option for people. The one thing you're going to want to keep in mind is you need to have good fences. Either you need to have really nice neighbors and or really good fences.
Why do you need nice neighbors?
Well, if your fences are not super great, again, sheep are grazers that keep their head down.
Uh-huh.
They just keep walking, you know, as they graze. And if there's a hole in the fence, they're going to go in. And goats, where they're browsers, they will jump on trees and rocks and anything like that. And they'll just jump over the fence.
So
you either have to have neighbors that you're really friendly with that will call you and say, hey, come get your sheep or your goats.
Well, tell me this. If you go into the sheep business, does that mean that you get to have a border collie or maybe a couple of those great dogs?
Yeah, even goat people have border collies too. So, yes, I love watching those dogs work. Like, I love the stock dog trials that come in. I have lots of female producers that are in their 50s and 60s. And they do a lot of the work on their own. And using those dogs has just been a key to their success because they don't have to have an extra set of hands necessarily to help round them up and do that kind of work.
Kelly Yates, Executive Director of the Kentucky Sheep and Goat Development Office. Thank you so much for joining us, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Dwayne Lundy hosts our series Depth of Field, talking with artists he's worked with as a studio engineer and producer, as well as others who have made it into his extensive Rolodex. His latest, singer-songwriter, Joe Pug.
Joe Pug, thank you for joining me.
Dwayne, it's my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, man.
As an observer of somebody who's both worked with you and a fan, one of the things I admire most is your ability to manage your time and your career. You're a dad, husband, touring artist, songwriter, and now you host a very successful podcast. Can you give us a little bit of insight as to how you get all this stuff tackled?
Sure. I'll give you a really, really boring answer. When I became a dad, that's when the time crunch really, really hit. I ended up making my email inbox my to-do list. Basically, if I don't get an email about it, it doesn't exist in my work world at all. So I send myself emails all the time, and then I snooze them for different dates to come up at a time to tell me what to do. And then when I wake up in the morning on any given day and I have time to work, I just open up my inbox, and whatever's in my inbox email-wise, that's what I have to do that day.
So there's that side, and then there's the creative element. Do you find it difficult to flip that switch?
You know, creativity doesn't like to be turned on like a light switch, you know, and it's really hard to make it want to fit in that box. So typically what I do is I let kind of songs come to me when they come, and I'll record a voice memo about it, and I'll try to get as much as I can in that voice memo done at the time, because they just kind of come when they come. I'll sing it into the phone. And then I have, when it's time to do creative work, hopefully I can open up those notes and hopefully I can kind of touch whatever original spark that was and get it going. But I won't lie to you. I mean, it's not like it used to be. I had a lot more time to just sort of sit with my divining rod in the air waiting for lightning to strike it. And these days, if there is lightning striking, I don't always have my arm in the air to catch it.
Well, I can definitely understand that. As a writer, where the editing process comes in for you, it's one of your great strengths.
It used to be I'd generate an immense amount of material, and then right before I got to the studio or in the studio, I would edit it down. Now, I tend to edit as I go. I'd say the main thing is I know sooner when something is not going to work.
I must admit, one thing that is of the moment is this mentality of template. You see even online people selling their templates, how-to, tutorials on everything, in a really sort of step-by-step, paint-by-numbers type of way of approaching art. How do you find yourself workshopping, writing, all the things that you have to do in an efficient manner, but not getting into that template mentality all of the time?
I've never been a template guy. I just don't write that way. I don't have to write that way because I'm not having to write volume. I'm a guy that's never had like a publishing deal either, right? So I don't have like a certain amount of songs I have to turn in every year. My boss is basically my audience and the people that listen to me, and they're usually pretty patient with me. So I don't need a template to create at volume. If I had to hit a certain mark at a certain point, that would be the only way that you could do it. But no, I've never had the template thing. And to me, you can't learn how to write songs as a general matter. You can learn how to write the thing that's right in front of you and get that perfect. And then when you get on to the next song, it's kind of surprising how little that last song will teach you about the current song that's in front of you.
You and I had a conversation a few years ago that I found really interesting and inspiring. You were bringing the same type of creative element to the business apparatus of what you were doing that you do in the studio and in your writing of the songs and the material. Is that something that you genuinely enjoy, or is that something that you have to work at?
Well, I guess my mindset on it could be best described by this anecdote. A couple of years ago, I had to buy a very specific type of insurance for when I went on the road. Basically, I was buying insurance in case something were to happen to me, like I lopped off a hand or something like that, or something happened to my voice, I would be covered with my income for a couple years because, you know, for me, that would be a problem if something happened to my voice or my hands. I have a family. So I had to shop for this very specific type of disability insurance, and it was really hard to find. And I finally found a insurance broker who, he found some pool of risk with, like, you know, Cirque du Soleil performers or something like that. And he finally got me this insurance, the premium on it being, you know, relatively pricey. But when he got it, I was really excited about it and really effusive. And I just thanked him a lot. I was so excited. And he was kind of confused. He was like, I don't understand you, man. Like, most people, they don't want to talk to their insurance guy. And, you know, this is kind of an expensive policy. And why are you excited about this right now? And from my perspective, I love what I do for a living so much. I love making art. I love making records. I love playing shows. And I didn't feel like I could continue to do that work if I didn't limit my family's liability. So I was really nervous about getting that sort of business part of it to work. So once I got the business part of it to work, it was really exciting to me.
Have you found yourself, especially during this, you know, 14-month period that we've just, you know, been through and hopefully are to a degree coming out of, influenced by other art forms?
I would say for me, this lockdown has actually been the lack of media that I've been consuming. I've been with my kids so much, and they're both under 4 years old. I spend an immense amount of time doing the hurry up and wait. When I used to be on the road all the time, I'd always have a podcast in my ears. I'd always have a Kindle, some sort of media bombarding me, you know, so I didn't have to like feel my feelings or whatever.
Do you ever find yourself interested in taking what it is that you do and moving it into other art forms, writing plays? I know you have a history with that, short stories, novels.
I've certainly thought of that, of working in another medium. I've tried in the past. I went to college for playwriting, but what I've really settled on is I think it's enough for me to try for the rest of my life to simply try to write. This is going to sound glib, but it really isn't. To write, I'm trying to write the best song ever written. Like, that's what I'm trying to do on a day-to-day basis. That is what I visualize my purpose in life to be. I don't know, man. I'm pushing 40 now. Like, I feel like I know what I want to do. I feel like I know what, when things are going at their very best, I do have the capacity to be exceptional at. So it's hard to find something like that in life. So I'm just hanging on to that like a dog to a bone.
That's interesting. This is the second week in a row that the subject of age has come up in both you and my last guest, Zach Brock. Seem to be in genres and fields of the music industry that actually benefit from age and the wisdom that comes with that and the refinement of your skill set. What is your view on ageism and age as it relates to your art?
Yeah, I really, just on a personal level, I've actually enjoyed getting older. I remember in my 20s not knowing how to do anything and being keenly aware that I didn't know how to do anything. And so now I don't feel old, but I know how to do more things. But then as far as the work goes, yeah. I mean, I think just from like a very superficial aesthetic level, the specific type of music that I play, which I think you could just call Americana music. I think that's like the marketing term for it. But I think when you say that, people understand what it is. Or just singer-songwriter music in general. Just from a superficial aesthetic level, it'll be better to have a little bit of salt and pepper on the temples because it will make the songs come with a bit more authority to a lot of listeners.
18 months to 3 years. That's sort of the cycle that I think of when I think of the music business, between the making of the albums, the writing, the touring, the press, so on and so forth. What does the next 18 months to 3 years hold for you?
I have decided to really focus on releasing a lot more music, releasing it on a more regular basis. And so I'm putting an immense amount of time into that, whereas my time used to be spent planning tours and going on tours and playing live. I'm really going to cut that down to, it had gone down in 2015. I did something like 220 shows that year. Then I had kids, took it down to like 90 or 100. And now post COVID, I'll probably do 30 or 40 shows a year. And then when I'm not watching my kids, I'll be writing and recording music.
The Working Songwriter is the name of your podcast. When you were cooking up the idea of doing a podcast, did you have some primary motivations that you wanted to accomplish artistically, or was it an economic thing, or just tapping into the minds of other songwriters?
Yeah. So I started the podcast, The Working Songwriter, about 5 or 6 years ago, and it basically stemmed from having been through the album process, the album release process, so many times, and talking to publicists before it happened and game planning with them of how we could get onto somebody else's show. At first they were like, oh yeah, we'll get you this. We'll get you late night with such and such. We'll get you this great radio program. And then at the end of the day, they don't get you anything. So I just viewed that as a real inefficiency. And so I thought to myself, what if I built my own platform? What if I built a platform where other people have to ask me to be on the show? And I knew that it would take a long time But now I'm on the other side of that long play. I basically built it so I didn't have to ask people if I could come on their shows anymore. I just wanted to have my own thing.
Absolutely. And that's an inspiration for artists. I mean, we have to look at things a little bit differently. The template mentality, the old way of putting things out, promoting your career, is just not working in the same way that it once did. And for a great deal, never did work.
It's an overwhelming business because it changes constantly. There's a million people that want to do it, and there's a million people that would do it for free. So unless you have some sort of jump out of the gym ability as a singer, as a guitar player, to some degree as a songwriter, you know, why should you get the gig and why shouldn't the other million people over there get the gig, you know?
In the spring of 2014, I had the great pleasure with Joe and his band to hunker down in the studio here in Lexington, Kentucky, and make an album called Windfall. Here's the song Bright Beginnings from that effort. Hope you enjoy.
Bright beginnings often fade. Precious few can keep the flame. All I have, I give to stand beside that brightness once again.
Joe, thank you so much for being with us. I greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dwayne. Thanks.
I'm Dwayne Lundy. Thanks for joining us. This was Depth of Field.
I don't know, but I could swear we left our better selves somewhere. These days all we do, it seems, chase our checks and call them dreams.
Journalist Alan Maiman was with us in June discussing his new book, Twilight and Hazard, and Diversifying the Eastern Kentucky Economy.
The urgency of the situation is being recognized, and some really smart people are thinking about how to do this.
Maiman will be in the region later this month with stops at Carmichael's Bookstore in Louisville on the 24th, Joseph Beth in Lexington on the 25th, and Red Spotted Newt in Hazard on the 27th. You can get details on the sites of these shops. And want to set up an urban farm in your town? A model is being celebrated on the 29th. The 15th anniversary of the Berea Urban Farm gets underway at 5:30 with an open house, live music, and a look to the future of urban farming and an auction of all kinds of things related to food. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.